Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Today's podcast is an interview that we had an opportunity to do with Dr. Robert Kramer. Mm-hmm. He's an assistant professor, or associate professor, associate professor of community health at Old Dominion University.
Right.
And he has had, his background he's done all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At one point in the interview, he talks about the different things he's done around the world, where he's worked in Australia and in different places in Europe, here in the United States.
Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, he has a rich and varied background.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to interview him because of his work in suicide and suicide prevention.
Right.
But his background is much broader and deeper than merely suicide. But he really knows this topic.
Right.
So I'm glad we had him on. He really is he's an internationally recognized expert.
Yeah.
And it goes across, he's worked in forensic psychology, mm-hmm. developmental psychology, cross-cultural, worked with diverse populations, indigenous populations in Australia. So he has a vast background in this topic. But we were particularly interested in his work in suicide and suicide prevention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much information out there about mm-hmm. suicide and suicide prevention. It was great to talk to somebody who's actually an expert, who does trainings.
He does his own research, and he does trainings.
He's not a clinical psychologist, so he's not licensed clinically to work with patients, but what he does is he really digs into the research and looks mm-hmm. at what the research says and conducts his own research into this topic and into, you know, what is going on mm-hmm. in people's lives that result in some of this. So,
you know, one of the things that I was that I was glad to hear from him is that the suicide hotlines and the suicide prevention programs that we typically rely on, he encourages people to use them. He said they're very good and they have very practical and very accurate information.
Yeah.
Very frequently you have these hotlines or these programs that don't really provide accurate or useful information. And he said over and over again, no, use the suicide hotline.
Yeah.
Use these sites. They have the best information about warning signs and what you should do and what advice you should give to people. So
absolutely.
I was glad to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's just, you know, when he speaks, you know that he's speaking with mm-hmm. with experience and with knowledge. And as you said, mm-hmm. he just threw that information out there.
It is at his fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell he does trainings. You said you mentioned that. You can tell he does trainings because this factual information is at his fingertips. I mean, he can just talk about it with ease and with authority.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. Yeah. So we hope you enjoy the podcast. There's a lot to learn from mm-hmm. what he has to share. If you're watching the video, it's a little grainy.
It's a little grainy.
At times the audio is great, so there shouldn't be any problems with that. Well, the audio is great most of the time. There's a little bit of an echo at times, and so we work to kind of toggle between the microphones a little mm-hmm. bit, but we think that worked out. So.
And the only problem is he has his doctorate from the University of Alabama.
I knew you were going to mention that.
I have to mention
it. I knew you were going to mention
we teased him about that a little bit because Florida and Alabama have this rivalry in football.
They do.
But he's a big fan. He's a big Alabama fan.
Yeah.
So
I think he threw Roll Tide in there a couple
he
times.
He did Roll Tide, times. Beginning and end. He began
That's
and
right.
ended with the Roll Tide prayer.
The vow.
So,
mm-hmm. so but we hope you enjoy the interview.
Yeah.
Again,
mm-hmm.
lots of great information. You can find a link to his Twitter feed in the show notes, and you can follow what he's doing, what he's got going on, because he does a lot of community stuff as well.
Right.
So there's all kinds mm-hmm. of things going up there in Virginia where he's living now.
Yeah, and it's her encouraging that Old Dominion is encouraging him to do this sort of community outreach.
Fantastic.
You know, there's so many universities where they don't want you to leave the institution, but it sounds like Old Dominion is encouraging him to get out there and do this community-based work.
Yeah.
And so kudos to Old Dominion for encouraging that sort of thing. So we appreciate it.
Absolutely. So hit him up, follow him on Twitter, and see what all he's got going on. So, all right. Well, we hope you enjoy the interview. Hey,
hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic.
Hey, can you guys hear and see me okay with the weather going on down there?
Absolutely. It's man, our stuff is so sketchy sometimes, especially when it's raining. And just as you were about to pick, just as you were starting to come on, we had a little crack of thunder. So it's always exciting.
Understood. I lived in Texas for a long time. Actually, Alabama and Texas, so I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where were you in Texas? I forgot.
I was lived in Houston, worked in Huntsville.
Oh, that's right. Huntsville. Right. We used to drive through there on our way back to Alabama. No. Terrible.
All Huntsville is good for. But that's right.
We've all lived in a few of those places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good to finally meet you.
Ditto. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound like you're a very busy fella.
Busier than I ever hoped to be, but all in a good way.
Really?
That's good. Well, I'd really like to hear more about some of that community stuff that you guys got going on up there. It sounds like that's really, really keeping you going.
Since getting into Norfolk, so I've been with Old Dominion now just over a year and a half. So this will be starting my second full academic year.
Mm-hmm.
Since being here, I've done more community-engaged work, whether it's on the research side, whether it's on just, you know, delivering local talks, workshops, or I'm actually part of a citywide suicide prevention steering committee that has gone into its own, you know, it's going to be mentally healthy Norfolk month in October with a series of citywide events that I'm a part of here or there planning. So it's been really, really different in a good way. Again, you know, busier than I had ever thought I would be.
Yeah.
Right. What is it about Norfolk? Is it Norfolk or is it the university or where's the community outreach? What's the impetus for that?
I think part of it's Norfolk because it's a military town. So
right.
We probably have some unique social norms, some social characteristics around here that don't exist other places I've been.
Right.
But you got to remember, I've been to New York, Baltimore, San Francisco, Huntsville, Texas, Tuscaloosa with a stopover or two abroad. But I think the timing, too, I don't think it's going to surprise you to hear me say that I think since November there's been a little bit more community activism around places.
November?
Let's see.
Yeah. Hmm. Not wanting to get too political. So.
Let's see.
We dance that dance.
Yeah.
Well, that does make sense. That does make sense up there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, especially the military. Yeah, military presence. Yeah.
And it seems like there's something new and unexpected that comes out just about every week nowadays, and including things related to the military came out the last week or two, right?
The transgender ban.
Right.
Which isn't actually a policy or a ban because... apparently, it was not run by nor approved through formal military channels. So,
yeah. It keeps everybody on their toes.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Never dull moment.
Never. Now, how did you get into the? I was reading in your bio that we're gonna sort of do your whole introduction and everything,
sure.
Too. But in your introduction, you you have a lot of different experiences, even with just the cities that you described, you know, living in and traveling through. How did you get to where you are now?
how long you got? I think very early on in undergrad, I was socialized to two things. One was some very practical career advice to learn to integrate research interests. Right, so whether it's interdisciplinary perspectives or, you know, merging My abilities maybe as a quantitative methodologist with a community agency and bridging that research to real world practice and partnership, that's really opened up a lot of doors. Mm-hmm. And so I've always sort of partnered with the type of institutions or agencies that were naturally available.
That makes
maybe
sense.
Maybe by geography or by discipline of the part I was in.
Right,
the second
right.
piece is that my grad mentor really opened my eyes to multicultural issues and international work. So I've done some visiting appointments since 2007. In 07, I was lucky enough to do an international summer fellowship in Australia at University of South Australia. And since then, I've done short-term visiting, teaching, and research in Prague, in the UK, back to Australia. So it's really been a function of interdisciplinary thinking and cross-cultural push from my doctoral mentor.
That's fascinating. As an undergraduate, I started out as a co-major, and then interestingly enough, my advisor advised me not to do a co-major. But I basically did a minor in anthropology because I think that these different cultural perspectives are fascinating. I mean, especially when we think about them from a psychological perspective and just psychodevelopmental perspective. So it must be a fascinating experience.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of work I've done, the work that I'm doing in the international, with international partners, it's funny, it's been very different topics even. You know, so in 07, I was placed on a fellowship to do some personality theory testing and ultimately suicide and violence risk were with pre-adjudicated offenders.
Oh.
And since then I've done some ethnic minority interaction research with police back in Australia, with colleagues at Griffith University. And then I'm doing some suicide prevention work with colleagues in the UK and Vienna, and even starting up in Scotland as well. And yes, there are a lot of multicultural differences, but one of the things that's lacking and one of the things that we're trying to do is really look at maybe testing similarities and differences of how some of these theories do play out across borders. You know, again, most of the work I've done internationally is going to have to do with suicide, some of it with multicultural social psych and prejudice kinds of things as well. So,
Gotcha. Yeah. So how did you get involved into suicide prevention? Because that's going to be our main topic
tonight. I would say that was a clinical interest of mine before it was a research interest. So I did my PhD in clinical psychology with a forensic emphasis at University of Alabama. Roll Tide. love the alma mater. Love me some Nick Saban.
We'll leave that in.
Okay. And I interned 2 years at a university counseling center. And, you know, going in, of course, there's the stereotypes of college students being the worried, well, you know, it's going to be nothing but test anxiety. I think within my first 3 months there, I had 4 or 5 active suicide risk assessments.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And to back up, I mean, at a younger age, much like many people, I mean, if you really take the numbers, most of us, by the time we're a young adult, know somebody who is outwardly acknowledged experiencing suicidal ideation or attempt, right? So I had those early experiences well in high school, just like many people did, just knowing someone.
Right.
But I think on the clinical training end, I really got socialized or some professional experience, some real world experience, and it really captured me as a way I can make a difference. Now I'm not a licensed clinical psychologist. So I want to be clear about that. I'm in the research, teaching, training, and advocacy end.
Gotcha.
With all the potential hats. So I'm training the health professionals, I'm doing the research, I'm, you know, but it's really informed by that frontline clinical experience. And after that counseling center work, I did training in inpatient psychiatric, outpatient psychiatry, corrections, a couple other places where, of course, this stuff is also unfortunately frequent. I don't have to tell you guys. You guys see patients. And,
right.
So I think for me, it became much more of a pressing professional experience and interest than anything else.
Okay. Hey, Rob, if we can go to this, back to suicide for a second.
Sure.
I'm reading different publications, And invariably, one says suicide rates are declining. The others say suicide rates are increasing.
Yep.
Which is it?
In the U.S., okay, so caveats on this question. One, we don't always know that a death by suicide is a death by suicide.
Right.
Take
right.
a stereotypical one car accident into a poll.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always know if that's a suicide or just a car accident.
Right.
So with the caveats of what we have to talk about known suicides. Over the last 10 years or so, if you follow the best available data, which in my opinion comes from the CDC, at least in the U.S., you do see that it's increasing, although some statistical tests will show a statistically significant increase year to year or over time. Some, it's flatlined and maybe just more a function of increasing population or better detection. So that's my long-winded and evasive way of saying I think it's going up and the best available data suggests that, but it's not that simple.
Is it going up in the other countries?
World Health Organization data would suggest that, again, similar problems, especially when you're trying to track it in countries. There's a great 2014 WHO report on violence all told, and that's where they put and where CDC puts mm-hmm. suicide. They capture it or categorize it as self-directed violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're trying to capture, you know, in middle income or lower income countries, they're fraught with even more reporting issues. So with all of those caveats, yeah, World Health Organization data also suggests that it's increasing, as well as, you know, the best proxy data we have from, you know, Journal of the American Medical Association studies, suicide and life-threatening behavior, that kind of stuff. So I'd say overall and in general, it's rising. The question becomes, what are the vulnerable groups and how can we do something about it?
Mm-hmm. The vulnerable groups, I assume, are the same across countries, right?
Not always.
No,
they're actually not always. So taking Australia, for example, their indigenous population, Aboriginals, are certainly at elevated risk, but we don't really have that population
right.
here. So
right.
the closest thing we would have would be Native American, which of course are at risk for things like alcohol and suicide as well, but it's not always a one-to-one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is the lay lesbian, gay community at risk in other countries as it is here, at risk for self-harm and suicide?
I think so. I think mm-hmm. You can't paint it broad strokes of U.S. versus other countries, right?
Because
you have, again, wanting to avoid the overly political terminology, but you have more open societies mm-hmm. and you have more closed societies. You have more progressive and permissive and accepting and less so. And so from a public health perspective, I would say that the extent to which
to mute his microphone.
The society is more open and accepting,
mm-hmm.
the less pronounced the risk is likely going to be.
Right.
Hey,
Rob, before we leave, can I have one quick question? What did you call the college students? The worried well?
That was one of the stereotypes that still pervades. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Yeah, I like the phrase. I hadn't heard that before.
In misconception, I'd actually like to break a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Depression, anxiety, suicide rates among college kids are increasing, among other things.
Oh, okay. So that is one group where it is increasing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what about there are these groups that, you know, gain special attention that we think about when we think about, you know, suicide risk and things like that. You mentioned the LGBTQ right. Population and group of people. What about, you know, do you know of research or is there research that looks at people who are maybe victims of bullying? You know, whether it's in teenagers or adults or even geriatrics, you know, we hear some of these different populations and that the suicide risk is different in some of these different groups.
Absolutely. So the majority of the bullying and victimization literature that I'm going to be familiar with is going to be LGBTQ youth because that's sort of one of the areas that I've specialized in.
Gotcha.
We certainly know that bullying or victimization or even involvement in bullying, there's this interesting overlap between, you know, kids who are bullies are sometimes victims and sometimes victims become bullies. It's that in the criminological literature, it plays out later in adulthood as people who are victims are more likely to be perpetrators and perpetrators likely to be victims. So I think you have to talk about these things interconnectedly in terms of bullying and victim. Certainly a risk factor for negative mental health outcomes like suicidal ideation. I think that's well understood, especially among adolescent samples, LGBTQ, or other just minority groups. I'm sure that there's also workplace violence, workplace bullying literature that would support that. How that's playing out under, you mentioned older age or gerontology, geriatrics. I'm not as much familiar with that literature.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And it's fascinating when you were talking about the bullying literature and the way that the literature talks about that sometimes the bully is themselves a victim. We just did a podcast earlier this week where we were just talking about that specific phenomenon that, you know, many times the bully of one victim is actually the victim of another bully. And that sort of runs a cycle or creates a cycle that could certainly result in, as you're saying, the risk for maybe we automatically sort of intuitively think of the victim as being at risk for suicide, but maybe the bully as well.
That's actually a broader pattern that you'll see observed in the criminology literature. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is in many forms of interpersonal violence, whether it's cyberbullying, whether it's regular bullying, whether it's intimate partner violence or sexual violence, you see that the victim often is at risk for becoming a perpetrator.
Right.
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 And so a lot of the associated outcomes, whether they're healthy relationships, unhealthy relationships, physical health, mental health, often apply both to the victim and the perpetrator.
All right. Gotcha. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question. You mentioned suicidal ideation. One of the questions we struggle with, and that many of our families struggle with, is what is the difference? And if you could address this, I'm thinking of them as the audience now with this question. There's a difference between suicidal ideation and suicidal intent. How do you talk about that issue with people you see?
This is actually a topic that I address in my trainings. So I do suicide prevention, risk assessment, and management trainings for any health professional. I've done them for VA, psychiatric nurses. I just gave grand rounds to Naval Hospital, Naval Medical Center, Portsmouth down here, on a set of core competencies that a health professional needs to really be effective in managing risk and assessing ongoing. And within that, one of those core competencies is assessing and picking apart suicide-specific content in a risk assessment. So for example, the difference between ideation and intent. I think the easiest way I have found to explain it, and that some of the literature would support, is that ideation is just very straightforwardly thinking about wanting to end one's life.
Mm-hmm.
I can have that thought without wanting to actually go through with it. Intent is very simply the way I would explain it and the way I would assess it as a clinician is, to what extent does the person actually want to carry through? Now, more complex, I'll throw up a PowerPoint slide in my training materials. And if you guys are interested in any of this stuff and follow up, I'm happy to give it to you.
Awesome.
I'll demonstrate intent as a continuum from thought to actual behavior. Now, that thinking regarding intent might be, do I have a plan? Do I really want to do this? Do I really want to end my life? Or is it just something I'm struggling with as a coping mechanism? All the way through to behaviors like preparing. Am I stockpiling pills? Have I gotten a firearm? Do I know the method? Do I have access? And so what also often correlates with the discussion of intent is access to means. Mm-hmm. And will the person use those means? Right. That's how I would differentiate them in a simple, in a short conversation like this.
Right.
Within the trainings, I provide a lot more research literature context, because I think one of the things you guys are picking up on is intent is ill-defined in the literature, and that's one of the problems. It's used as an IV, it's used as a dependent variable in research, it's gauged by proxies like presence of a weapon,
mm-hmm.
but there's not really a great measure for it, other than maybe, to my knowledge, within things like the suicide cognition scale by Thomas Ellis and his group. But
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's going to be really helpful. And that would be that graphic would be great to see, and we could even, it would be great to be able to use that to help share with people that we work with. And you know, I'm sure, or I would assume that up in the areas that you're working and you know, with the people, the professionals that you're working with, you know, over the last couple of months, there's been this huge discussion of that Netflix program, 13 Reasons Why. And, you know, a lot of people have been, you know, it has enjoyed varied accolades, some very critical and very some positively critical. But, you know, one of the big things that seems to come out of it is this whole discussion about what are the warning signs of suicide? You know, could these people have known? You know, should somebody have picked up on it? Should her parents have done something? I would love to hear your thoughts about that program in general, if you care to share. But also, you know, what do you talk about in your work as far as the warning signs of suicide?
Let me start there, and then I'll work backwards to the 13 Reasons Why. American Foundation of Suicide Prevention is probably, in my estimation, the best resource for materials on risk factors and warning signs. So a risk factor is going to be anything that's going to increase likelihood of suicidal thinking, attempt. Whereas a warning sign, the way I explain it in my trainings is, you know, it's those immediate observable, often behavioral signs. But in terms of warning signs that people can pay attention to, it's just like any other issue: thoughts, feelings, behaviors. So any warning sign has to be out of the character for a person. So let's say that the person starts talking about the topic of death. Well, I know a lot of people who talk about death as part of their job, maybe my pastor, right? Or as part of a philosophy class. So what we're talking about are warning signs in thoughts, feelings, and behavior that are out of character for the person. So behaviorally, this may look like social withdrawal. It may look like a decrease in energy. It may look like preparatory behaviors, like giving away prized possessions, tying up relationships. In terms of expressed words and thinking, it's indications that the future is hopeless, that the person is beating themselves up outwardly, indicating that they might be a failure or low self-esteem or anything like that. If any of your listeners really want to gather a comprehensive yet really user-friendly picture of thoughts, feelings, behaviors that are warning signs, those observable signs right before an attempt that you can recognize, American Foundation of Suicide Prevention is the best easy resource.
Okay. We'll definitely throw up a link to that so people can follow them, follow it, check it out, and that's great. American Society of Suicide.
AFSP, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Okay, perfect.
Yep. Perfect.
Excellent. So again, you know, so when we, not trying to force the issue with 13 Reasons or anything, but, you know, we Richard and I did a little series on the program, and we talked a lot about it. And because I think that a lot of people were extremely critical of the program, and you know, they looked at different things like when she cut her hair and when she did some of these different things that, oh, that should have been a warning sign. That should have been, you know, somebody should have picked up on that. Somebody should have picked up on this. And I like what you're saying, that it's not so much the particular behavior. It's that the behavior is outside of their norm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that I think that's a big point.
All right.
Another point related to 13 Reasons Why, or maybe more so, two things always came to mind when 13 Reasons Why would be brought up. One, from the public health education standpoint, is that I think self-injury is misunderstood by the lay public, and it's sensationalized or glamorized or just spoken about in an uneducated manner. So I think a take-home that I would hope somebody listening or watching this would take is that self-harm doesn't always equate to suicide. And in fact, the literature on adolescents or other vulnerable groups like incarcerated offenders shows that self-harm is actually an unhealthy coping strategy. It's serving functions for people, very often adolescents, like expressing emotion and hurt, a genuine, authentic cry for help, things like that. And so I think that part of the uproar with 13 Reasons Why is that they didn't really depict that accurately. They did it in a way that probably perpetuated some stereotypes about adolescent suicide and self-harm rather than promoting the science.
Gotcha.
The other thing that comes to mind, and again, I mean, I saw this just like you guys probably did in numerous op-eds and in the statement, I think, from American Association of Suicidology or from AFSP. One of the issues that many people took with the way that it was handled in the actual visual is what they showed. You got to remember that the science behind adolescent brain development is that their brain has not matured. And practically speaking, what that means, they don't have the abstract reasoning skills. They don't have the ability to think through or plan like the average 35-year-old has. And so when they're watching images like that, okay, they're susceptible to something called contagion,
to what?
Which is literally mimicking the behavior.
What are we talking about?
And so the way that it was depicted on 13 Reasons Why, you actually see it being associated with increased Google searches or web searches for suicide among adolescents and increased self-injury.
Yeah, that we talked a little bit about that. And, you know, because the issue that we found was that, of course, it was rated TV-MA, and so it wasn't intended, I think, for adolescents for much of that same reason. And you know, the concern that we had and the things that we try to help educate, you know, our listeners for was that, you know, this is a program, you know, certainly not for especially young teenagers. It was a program for, well, for whatever audience, it obviously it was for an adult, mature audience. And, you know, that parents were going to have to do a pretty good job of listening to their teens and getting involved well enough to where they could have a conversation, maybe much like you're saying, to help them better cope with what they saw instead of mimicking and copying some of the things that they saw.
Agreed. Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of consternation. Consternation. That's Richard's word.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
you know,
a good word for it.
But it went. But that brings us to one of our next questions is, when parents come in, frequently they will reference the movie because they're not sure what to be looking for. What do you tell them about recognizing the possible signs of suicide in a loved one, in a child or a sibling?
That education is key. I even end that, that's my ending theme with even the trainings I do for health professionals, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists, that continuing education is important. So I look at it this way. 20, 30 years ago, if you go around, CPR wasn't exactly mainstream.
True. Yeah.
And now it is.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see basic mental health first aid become that. And that's how I might open the conversation. That the simplest way to do that and to learn that is to educate yourself through formal or informal channels. Those informal channels might be calling up a provider and consulting, asking the very questions that you guys are asking me today about warning signs and how do you address the topic, getting good, reputable resources from a library or from a mental health professional. Or more formal channels called gatekeeper trainings. From the public health perspective, there's lots of good educational programs like Safe Talk or QPR that are designed for public audiences that train people in basic skills. What are the basic facts about suicide? How do you recognize the warning signs? And then how do you engage in a conversation with somebody about it? How do you be supportive and direct, yet not overly aggressive to shut the person down or evasive so that they can get out of having the conversation?
Right.
Gatekeeper training is important.
Right. You've had quite a bit of clinical experience in various places. In Florida, we have this thing called a Baker Act. In Florida, we have something called the Baker Act, which is involuntary hospitalization. we feel that frequently people are Baker-acted, they're involuntarily hospitalized at the mere mention of suicide. Do you have something similar either in Texas or Alabama or now in Virginia where you can pull that trigger and send somebody to involuntary hospitalization for fear of suicide?
I cannot do that because I am not a licensed provider, but those laws exist across the country. So another one of the competencies I provide in my training are legal and ethical issues. Mm-hmm. And the first legal issue that we cover is involuntary psychiatric hospitalization.
Right.
That type of law exists in some form or fashion in every state.
Right.
I would say that a lot of clinicians probably tend to jump to it too quickly.
Right.
Because of anxiety and because of their own fears and sort of a CYA mentality.
I was going to say liability.
AMA would call it practicing defensive medicine, mm-hmm. right? Practicing mm-hmm. defensively rather than transparently and ethically.
Right.
And so the way that I talk about the psychiatric hospitalization issue, first, you know, just the basic education that most laws contain prongs for threat to self, threat to others, and some have, like, you know, gross inability to care for themselves. Mm-hmm. It just depends on the state. But that it's not as simple in most states as one medical provider saying, this person's got to go. Sometimes it takes more than one provider, or sometimes it takes the law enforcement or admitting person hearing the patient say, yes, I am suicidal, or they can't admit or they can't transport.
Okay. That's great to know. I don't know that it's necessarily like that here in Florida. We've certainly had some very sad stories working with some of our patients who end up in the hospital, and then, you know, they have to, one of the things that the hospital does try to do is make sure that they have somebody on the outpatient side ready to see them, you know, within a couple of days of their discharge. And, there are some very interesting circumstances by which even young children as young as, you know, 11 or 12 or 13 years old, being hospitalized because somebody said something, and they end up being hospitalized. And, you know, and for many of them, it's a very, I hate to use the word traumatic, but it's almost a pretty serious experience for them when they probably weren't truly suicidal to begin with. And I think a lot of it goes back to what you were saying earlier with that sort of misunderstanding or misappreciation of what self-harm is and that difference between intent and ideation.
Mm-hmm. I would use the word traumatized, quite frankly, that it can be. It's not always. In some cases, I would hope in many cases, it's actually warranted and helpful. But mistaken cases or rushing to hospitalize certainly can be traumatic, especially for an adolescent. Mm-hmm.
In a related vein, we have schools in our area who, if a teenager mentions, oh, I'm going to kill myself, they remove the child from the school and they ask us to do a risk assessment. Do you talk about that in any of your trainings?
I certainly cover the topic of risk assessment in terms of methods, procedures, key factors, so on and so forth. In terms of applying it to school settings, I have two colleagues who I'm working with now, one in Cincinnati, one in, actually both at University of Cincinnati, who specialize more in that adolescent school suicide prevention, suicide assessment domain.
Right.
But I've definitely covered the topic.
Okay.
Is there something in particular you were wondering about it?
Yeah, because we're put in a position of assuring the school.
They hope that we can assure the
right.
school.
Right, and it's a difficult call to make. In most cases, of course, it's not a serious threat. But you always wonder, am I missing something?
Well, I think the best that you can do, being the clinician in that situation, is have it understood going in what you're going to need access to make the best informed recommendation or determination of risk. You know, you're going to need school records. You're going to need access to parents, guardians, whomever is present, you know, collateral information. At that point, I mean, I would be operating or recommending to operate from the standards of practice for any assessment, multiple methods of assessment, converging data, and transparency in my clinical formulation to my risk determination. Ultimately, it's up to the school then to follow through on the recommendations. I mean, I don't think I have to tell you guys that schools vary in their willingness and ability to engage with these topics in a positive way.
Yeah,
the private schools, well, that's so.
Yeah, so we've kind of gone through, as we've talked about these different things, we've kind of gone through much of the process, and we were talking earlier about the some of the warning signs, and you know, what might you see in someone who's genuinely or maybe authentically experiencing suicidal ideation or has some suicidal intent, and something that you suggested a moment ago, and I just wanted to make sure that we reiterated it, is that you know, we need to make sure that we're talking to the person. That misnomer that you don't want to ask about suicide, because if you ask about suicide, it's going to introduce the idea of suicide to the non-suicidal person or something like that. And we know that none of that's true, really. But so what should a parent or a teacher or someone, or maybe even a clinician, what should someone do if they encounter a person, a teenager, a child, or even an adult or loved one who is experiencing suicidal ideation? What's the best way for them to respond?
The best way to respond, I would say, is consistent. The best way to ask about it is going to differ based on the person's age. The best way to respond is with absolute support. So some of the things not to do: be punitive or angry toward the person or blaming toward the person who's experiencing this. Don't shut them down. Don't tell them you shouldn't feel that way. That is just shaming to them.
Right.
I mean, you hear those stories all the time. Don't ignore it and don't try to shove it under the rug. The things to do are to build a supportive system around the person. So if there's, like, one of the things that I had to deal with when I was doing outpatient work was making very careful decisions on who to involve. Because if you know somebody in that person's network, social network or family network is the trigger or a source of stress, you don't want to involve that person.
Right.
Just as an example. Generally speaking, how you address the question or the topic of suicide with somebody is direct yet supportive. So the tangible examples I'll give in my trainings is that you communicate understanding or you communicate caring. Look, I've noticed that you haven't been yourself lately. Here's one or two things I've seen. I care about you. You matter to me. Have you thought about killing yourself, or have you thought about hurting yourself? It's direct yet supportive. It's clear. It's precise. The language is clear. It doesn't look like, well, you know, I don't know. How are you doing? That's evasive, right? That's avoiding the topic.
Right.
It's also not, what's wrong with you? You haven't been yourself. Buck up.
Yeah.
It's not aggressive. It's not going to shut the person down.
Right.
An important caveat, though, that if you're going to, you know, having that conversation with somebody 12, 13, 14, 15, remember, they can't express themselves in the same way. Or even having that person, that conversation with maybe a 25-year-old young adult who might have intellectual capacity limitations or things like that, where emotional expressivity might be different or limited. You have to take those kinds of things into consideration in the complexity of the language you use. So another recommendation I always have for parents, family, clinicians, is to listen to the person's language and match their language. Listen to how they're describing their feelings of anxiety or depression. If they're not calling it depression, if they're saying, I'm down, I'm overwhelmed, use that language.
That's a great strategy, because that it validates their feelings. It makes them, it lets them know that you're listening and that you're you know, appreciating what they're saying and where they're coming from, and it certainly is going to increase the likelihood of them continuing to talk to you. Because I really like the idea of not being confrontational about it, not being aggressive about it, just being just listening and just having that warm encouragement to continue the conversation.
Right. Rob, one other question I had, I think you addressed this earlier in the interview. The relationship between self-harm and suicide. I don't know that, I have to confess, I don't know that literature. We frequently see youngsters who are harming themselves. Does that increase the risk of suicide?
Yes. Okay. So any history of self-directed violence. Now, self-directed violence is an umbrella term for suicide and self-harm. Any history is going to increase the likelihood for future suicide risk.
Okay.
And there's some really interesting research across age groups looking at both trajectories, but also how that might be happening. So one of the leading theories of suicide, for example, is by Thomas Joyner at Florida State University. And it's a really simple and elegant theory that's seen quite a bit of support in the research, some of its pieces more than others. But he put forward this idea of developing the acquired capability, actually developing the idea, the ability to enact a suicide attempt. And one of the ways he says that happens is exposure to pain. Okay. Simple behavioral habituation. Well, think about it. If I'm engaging in self-injury, I'm exposing myself to pain. So that's one way that we think that self-injury might contribute to future suicide risk.
Makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. But we do have, in the new DSM-5, we have that, I think it's technically a formal diagnosis of non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. But it sounds like you're saying, you know, those behaviors, you know, put you at greater risk for that future suicidal ideation, potential suicide risk.
Suicide ideation and attempt and death by suicide. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There are meta-analyses or systematic reviews suggesting that.
Okay.
Helpful. Okay.
All right. Well, great. Is there anything else that you, I know we've kind of gone all over the place in this conversation with you, but is there anything else that you'd like to, that we haven't touched on yet, that you'd like to share with the listeners as it relates to whether it's suicidal prevention or anything else that you have going on?
Well, in terms of stuff going on, I mean, I'm involved in, in the Norfolk Steering Committee, and we're doing a lot of good things here in Norfolk, Virginia, that hopefully will become a model for other cities in terms of mental health awareness and suicide prevention. Tackling a lot of good work up there, so hopefully there'll be some press about it in the coming months. If anybody listens to your stuff, you know, maybe in Southern or Central Virginia or Northern North or Eastern North Carolina, that may be of interest. And then just generally speaking, I want to thank you guys for doing this kind of thing, because any kind of public health education through media of any kind these days is critically important to counteract things like 13 Reasons Why and the you know, sort of not intentional misuse, but the law of unintended consequences. Right. So I really appreciate you guys doing this, and I'd be happy to come back anytime, this topic or another one.
Well, you are certainly welcome.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Love to do it again.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Anything that you ever have going on that you'd like to share. I know we do have some listeners in that area, so you know, hopefully they'll hear this and be able to take part and be a part of what you're doing. And again, anytime you ever want to come back on, you know, just let us know, reach out, and you're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic, fellas. I really appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again so much, and you have a great day. Bye-bye.